Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. A very exciting post-election guest for all of you. That's Ross Douthat of The New York Times. Ross was actually on the podcast last as our very last in-person guest. And so, since he's coming on, as he makes reference in the episode, on the day that Pfizer announces their vaccine, which works in 90% of cases, maybe he is an omen for good things to come. But really why we wanted to have Ross on is he's one of the most insightful people on the American right. From his perch over at the New York Times, he hosts The Argument. He's long been an advocate for the working class GOP position that I obviously hold and have espoused and tried to work towards on this podcast and on my show Rising. And his take after the election is just absolutely invaluable.
The part I was most interested in was his pre-election op-ed that he put out the New York Times that basically summed up the period of 2016 to 2020 as a missed opportunity for basically every ideological and coalitional group in American politics. So that's the populist right, that's the establishment center, and it's the populist left. So regardless of whether or not you're a populist right winger trying to remake the GOP in your image, or you're a Bernie bro, or you're a think tank worker who's trying to see what both sides are saying, this episode has a lot of great stuff for you. But as you all know, every week we do realignment questions and ask that you give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It helps people find the show. But if you scroll down and leave us a question in the 5-star review or email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com with a screenshot of the review, we will read your question on air. So on to this week's question. This is from Alproa. Great name, Alproa. Love the show. It's nice to hear reasonable populist positions from a right-wing perspective. Is there any hope of a Sagar/Marshall political future? I'm hoping he's not referencing running for office. Let's say the realignment sort of framework moving forward. What do you think, Sagar?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a good question. And I would say, look, the results kind of validate anybody's theory here. If you're Joe Biden, you could be like, look, I just got a mandate for neoliberalism. If you're a progressive leftist, you can say, wow, Joe Biden barely won the election against Donald Trump because he wasn't offering anything up. That means we have to do Medicare for all. If you're populist right, you could say, hey, wow, look, Trump just won. All of these people in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, Miami-Dade County, and came within 150,000 votes across 4 different states of winning re-election, despite the fact that he didn't even really do all that much in his first term in office, at least from an industrial policy perspective. So here's where I kind of fall within that. Trump shows you a way forward, not the only way forward, a way forward, a way which I happen to agree with is the only possible way forward, which is that a non-Trumpian GOP or candidate, a future candidate who doesn't have, let's just say, the more distasteful elements of Trump himself, can win at least some of those college-educated white suburban voters back and would be able to win, hopefully, a larger multi-ethnic working-class coalition. But to do that, they are going to have to validate the best elements of Trump himself, ditch some of the parts of Trump which obviously turn people off. In essence, it's a compromise. It's not really a validation and a thesis giver of anyone. So what I'm going to be talking about a lot here on this podcast is that in my view, if the GOP ever wants to win a popular vote election or electoral college victory again, this is what they're going to have to do. Now, there are a lot of people in the party who don't actually want that. Secretly, they love being a permanent minority, especially if they have the Senate, because they can just sit there and play the opposition game all day long. It's very lucrative. They can make a lot of money doing it. They can play act doing something for their constituents while not doing anything and not talking about any of the positive agenda that I talk about here on this podcast. What do you think, Marshall?
Yeah, so 2 points here. Because the Trump era was so based around personalities, Trump, in many ways, people like AOC, we basically just hit a reset point because the players are going to shift a bit. So to your point, Sagar, there really are threads that everyone could sort of take from this. If you're a populist left person, and Ross references this on the show, you can take solace in the fact that Florida really passed a $15 minimum wage. That was a policy area where 4 or 5 years ago, that was out of reasonable bounds and something that really does represent a Bernie win for shifting the Overton window. If you're a centrist person, you really can say to your point, Sagar, hey, actually, there are a lot of people who want normalcy. There are ways that we can be more moderate on China. There are ways that we could change our language around free trade. And guess what? We could still sort of get what we want. It turns out that immigration is now more popular than it ever has been. So we really can moderate our rhetoric a bit, but still get our policy objectives. And then if you're on the populist right, you really look at the fact that our election is depolarizing away from race and towards class and gender and think there's a lot of things for you there. But all these things are going to come together and basically give us a depressing lost decade from a policy perspective. Sagar and I both get most excited on this podcast when we're debating things like the Green New Deal or just comprehensive immigration reform or even something like the RAISE Act. None of that's going to happen because of how divided Congress is going to be. And I just don't see any world where the coalitions that we have at hand have advanced or changed enough to shift this dynamic. And I also just don't see any politicians on the left, right, or center who have the talent to break through this area. The problem of our politics right now, and frankly, you sort of saw this with both AOC and Madison Cawthorn on election night, is that AOC is tweeting out enemies lists of Republicans who worked in the Trump administration. You know, good luck advancing a Green New Deal when you're doing that. You will literally not get a single Democrat or you will not get a single Republican to go along with you when you're diving that deep into the culture war. And then on election night, Madison Cawthorn, who I think hopefully when he first started running, talked about wanting to be the GOP voice on healthcare and wanted to do big things, he's retweeting things saying cry more lib. So you're seeing politicians enter into this process and then really just be brought low by it, even when the two of them in their own ways had a lot of promise coming in. So I just think we should get ready for all these really small tactical fights, debt ceiling crises, immigration border crises, and forget, that's what we're getting ready for. Forget big debates around the Green New Deal or any sort of bigger things. Like, Sagar, your nuclear renaissance is not coming this decade.
Oh, 100%. I completely agree with that. And if I have to hear about the goddamn debt ceiling ever again, I'm going to blow a gasket right here on that podcast. So before I lose it...
We'll do it live, by the way, if Sagar decides to do that. Man, so we'll do tickets.
I will absolutely lose it. So before I do, I'm literally getting angry just even thinking about another fight about that. Let's get into this conversation with Ross Douthat. He's absolutely incredible. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast and their successful Reboot Conference. You can find out more and watch more about what happened there, rebootconference.org. With that, let's dive in.
Ross Douthat, welcome back to The Realignment. We last spoke to you literally right before lockdown. You're our last sort of in-person guest, so we're still stuck on Zoom, but it's good to have you.
It's good to be back. And, you know, we're recording this with the Pfizer vaccine news in the headlines, so maybe the next time I'm on the show, we'll be all in person once again.
Ross, I think you're a good omen for things to come. So
yeah, maybe. Yeah. I come in at the end and the beginning.
Yeah. Ross, the last time we had you on, it was to discuss your book. Obviously, The Decadent Society, it's an incredible book. It's something that diagnoses, I think, a lot of the problems and could have highlighted some solutions, which I think could have led to a Trump victory if he had ever wanted to listen to you. My real question, I think, here on that vein is about missed opportunities. You and your colleagues at the New York Times did this excellent series about the things we lost. Yours is, in my opinion, one of the only ones that I really agreed with and wanted everyone to read. Shocker. But tell us about that. What do you think the missed opportunities for the so-called populist right, if you will, center and populist left are? Let's start with the right. What do you think the biggest missed opportunities, what did we lose as a result of Trump's presidency on the right that we could have had?
Well, I mean, you lost a moment where, in effect, the populist right took power to everyone's complete surprise and had basically every other faction in American politics, including other factions within the right, sort of back on their heels. Mm-hmm. And you had this window at the beginning of the Trump presidency where, you know, it seemed it really seemed like the normal rules of American politics had been suspended. And of course, this, you know, provoked a lot of fear and consternation among Trump's critics and enemies. But it also created an opportunity, I think, to sort of rethink how the Republican Party does policy and what its priorities are supposed to be. And, you know, for various reasons, that rethinking, some of it happened in, you know, small circulation journals and on op-ed pages and on podcasts like this one. It's been a very intellectually interesting 4 years on the American right. But in terms of what the Trump administration actually did, you know, you had much more sort of outsourcing of policy to the old guard of the Republican Party, especially in that first crucial year when I think there was an opportunity to make the Trump presidency actually popular and something other than just a kind of factional presidency trying to hold on to 45% of the country and win a narrow electoral college win.
Ross, what was interesting about your initial response is you referred to the populist right gaining power, but later on in your answer, you just referred to the Trump administration. So the thing I'm curious about is, were populists ever in control of the administration to the degree that that matters?
No. They were never in control of the administration. I mean, I think you could say that no one was in control of the administration. That might be a fair description of a lot of the Trump era. But I think what's accurate to say is that populist arguments won Trump the 2016 election. So when we say populist won in 2016, we don't mean that like a cadre of populist personnel were ready to take over. We mean that Trump himself made explicit arguments on, you know, the economy, trade, and so on that were populist. Those were crucial to his victory, and that created space and opportunities that then were mostly squandered.
So here's the question then. To what degree is there a populist right? So separate populism as a rhetorical tactic from the personalities here, because the thing that always interests me is, it seems to me what we're going to see moving into 2021 is lots of rhetoric around working class in a way that definitely wasn't there pre-2015 and definitely would have helped your book sales in 2008. But how, can you sort of comment on this sort of direction, if it's possible to separate working class populism from the sort of policy agenda that I think in many ways we'd like to see?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a version of right-wing populism that just sort of fits the left-wing caricature of the right, where it just takes the form of sniping at and critiquing liberalism and the liberal elite without having any kind of constructive policy agenda. And that kind of populism can be pretty popular because a lot of people, not just Republicans, dislike liberalism and its elite. So I think the sort of permanent question in right-wing politics is, you know, where is the balance going to be struck? You know, you're going to have, I think, any would-be leader of the Republican Party after Donald Trump, and that, you know, includes members of the Trump family and perhaps even Trump himself running again, but any person who aspires to lead the Republican coalition is going to pick up on some elements of Trumpian populism, and that will include some policy moves that you probably wouldn't have seen from a Mitt Romney or John McCain. I think there'll be a strong temptation to make those sort of, you know, cherries on top of the sundae where most of the ice cream is just rhetoric. That was a terrible, terrible mangled metaphor, but
it works.
You take my point.
Ross, here's my question too, which is that I think you're absolutely right. There is a version of right-wing populism which just, you know, is a reaction to the cultural elite, which again is pretty popular. It turns out you can take a look at the results of the 2020 election for a proof concept of that. My question is then, is let's extrapolate the what they lost question out more. What did the center left and neoliberal establishment lose, so to speak, in 2016 for the future, which they could have plausibly gained during Trump's presidency?
I mean, I think that there was a failure to achieve a failure of self-critique, basically.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you had the Trump phenomenon in 2016 exposed a large set of problems with neoliberal governance, you know, ranging from very specific things like, you know, like policy approach to China to more, you know, to sort of problems of elite alienation from, or maybe it's more appropriate to say sort of rural and heartland alienation from the centers of American power. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, fundamentally, what Trumpism revealed was a sort of slow burning social crisis in American life that had been exacerbated by economic policies that tended to benefit the highly educated and mobile upper middle class. And this social crisis manifested itself most starkly in things like the opioid epidemic, but more generally, it manifested itself just in support for populism, support for candidates like Donald Trump against the establishments of both parties, you know, deep skepticism about foreign wars and military entanglements and so on. And, you know, I mean, we're going to get a test of how much that neoliberal establishment has learned, because they're literally being returned to power. But it does seem like there was often a substitution of this kind of narrative of, you know, fascism on the march and authoritarianism on the march for a real reckoning with where that establishment and that sort of establishment consensus had gone wrong, right? So the idea that, you know, the biggest problem with Donald Trump was that he, you know, wanted to pull too many troops out of Afghanistan, right? And, you know, wasn't willing to have as many troops in Syria and so on. And that, you know, he wanted to sort of shift American priorities within the NATO alliance and so on. Like these kind of ideas, I think, to the extent that they sort of remain the ideas of the people who are going to take over foreign policy under Joe Biden, suggests that you could end up with, you know, scenarios of sort of further failed American interventions leading to backlash down the road, and the same on economic policy and so on. I mean, again, it remains to be seen, right? Like what is the Biden administration approach to China? We don't know yet. We don't know a lot of things. So we'll know more about what the centrists and the center left have learned over the next 6 months or a year.
Something I'm curious about is that certain segments of the right and the further left argued that 2016 really was this broad repudiation of that pre/post-Cold War order, and that there was just no going back. It seems to me, though, that everything we're talking about and everything that came out in the elections last week justify the idea that you can actually come back to a certain degree. And there's a world where a Biden administration is more hawkish on China, where they're less absolutist when it comes to free trade. And they're also sort of a little more, let's say, not unambitious, but a little more humble in their sort of approach to neoliberalism, that you could sort of have 2.0 second Obama term and still probably win re-election and have a decently comfortable set of politics. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, nothing in politics ever happens as sweepingly as it seems to have happened in the aftermath of an election, right? So, you know, mm-hmm. Donald Trump almost lost the 2016 election. And had he lost the 2016 election, no one would have talked about the sweeping repudiation of neoliberalism. And by the same token, Joe Biden nearly lost the Democratic primary to Bernie Sanders, in which case we would have a very different conversation right now about what, you know, the future of the Democratic Party and the left. I think what's true is that you aren't going back to exactly the realm of, you know, the sort of mid to early 2010s, right? You know, there is going to be a change in U.S. policy towards China, even if it's not as dramatic as some people on the populist right would like. There is, you know, some of the changes around NATO and foreign policy are probably baked in under any president. I think Biden will be more hesitant than Obama, who was more hesitant than George W. Bush to use force overseas, right? To do sort of regime change intervention. So those changes are real. And other changes are sort of baked in, right? Like the change in U.S. foreign policy occasioned by Israel's changing relationship to Arab states, that's not going away. I think an open question is what this means for sort of the culture war at home, right? Like, liberalism in the late Obama years was convinced that it had sort of won the culture war in some permanent way, and that, you know, that once it took over the Supreme Court, it could use the Supreme Court to sort of rout the last remnants of social conservatism. And obviously, you know, we now have a conservative Supreme Court, and that's probably not going to happen. So I wonder if the Biden administration will tread more carefully on, you know, using the bureaucracy to pick culture war fights, or whether it will just sort of feel pressure from within its coalition to go back to the same old, you know, battles over the Little Sisters of the Poor and issues like that. I don't know. But yeah, in some sense, you know, there are changes that can't be unchanged, but at the same time, neoliberalism is being restored to power. That is reality.
Well, that's really my question whenever it comes to the left, because the last people we kind of have to diagnose and see what they lost. I mean, Bernie Sanders did lose the Democratic primary. And yet, on certain respects, the identitarian left, or the absolutist identitarian left, which aligned itself most with Sanders, has won in some respects, especially if you look at the Biden administration and where they're planning to go in terms of immigration. I mean, a deportation moratorium in this country would be the most radical immigration policy that we've had in a modern generation. And even though it's not what Bernie would have done, it's still quite a bit of something. So how is it that you see how the progressive left lost the economic fight in some respects, but won the cultural fight? And broadly, how do you see it playing out in a Biden administration? Because that is kind of how I see things beginning to trend. Executive orders.
I mean, I think they won. So one, they lost the economic fight to the extent that they, you know, lost the primary, and then failed to have progressive candidates do nearly as well in the election we just saw as they expected. So in that sense, the economic left can claim legitimately to have moved the Democratic Party substantially to the left, right? Like, on economic policy, Biden did run to the left of Obama in certain ways. But the sort of big picture goals, Medicare for all, and sweeping things like that, on those issues, they seem to have been temporarily beaten. On the cultural stuff, they've won victories by essentially shifting their focus to the remaking of elite institutions, right? Yeah. And elite institutions, I mean this very broadly, to include, you know, things like the education bureaucracy that obviously has effects for, you know, not just elite students, but students generally. I mean, I think that's where, you know, the events of the last year especially have shown that the identitarian left just sort of has a lot of room to push in terms of, you know, what happens in elite university, what happens in spaces that were considered liberal to begin with, but can become sort of more culturally left-wing. But again, the outcome of the election, the fact that, you know, Biden didn't win a 10-point victory, Democrats, you know, may not take the Senate, lost seats in the House and so on, combine that with Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court, and you don't have a landscape that's incredibly favorable to sort of the unification of cultural and political power, right? Like, the Supreme Court is not going to, you know, be pushing Ibram X. Kendi, you know, and white fragility, right, through the law. And Biden, there are things Biden can do via executive order, but they will be less, you know, what he does on immigration, whatever he does on immigration, will be less than what he could have done had he taken the Senate with a big cushion and with abolished the filibuster and so on. So you're still seeing political limits being placed on the identitarian left in ways that, you know, weren't necessarily going to be placed on them as of 6 months ago.
I want to push back on something you said, Sagar, and then get your thoughts on it, Ross. The commingling of immigration policy with the deportation order, with the sort of broader critical race theory test, because the difficult dynamic around Trump's administration was, if we're talking about what were the populist arguments that Trump made to win the election in 2015, 2016, immigration is high up there. But what then you see happen during his presidency, because of, frankly, callousness and incompetence, some toxic combination of both of those things. You see immigration from a sort of left perspective get more popular than ever, like the highest positivity ratings in a generation. So how do you think about immigration politics? I think it's a mistake to bracket comprehensive immigration reform with critical race theory things that were, I think, pretty clearly repudiated.
Yeah, I mean, with immigration, it's tricky because public policy on immigration is so thermostatic, right? Meaning that it swings to the left under Republican presidents and to the right under Democratic presidents. So if you look at policy itself, this was one area where, Trump can have claimed to dramatically change U.S. policy. We really are accepting many fewer immigrants than we did prior to the Trump era, although the coronavirus has played its own role in that as well. At the same time, public opinion has moved well to the left of where it was when Trump was running in 2016. So, and again, some of that is in reaction, just in reaction to Trump, some of it in legitimate reaction to some of the, you know, cruelties associated with the child separation policy and so on. I think what's the open question here is that, you know, at a certain point, nobody in the Trump White House was making the sort of moderate immigration restrictionist case in a public and prominent way. You had sort of sweeping cases being made by folks like Stephen Miller, not much of an argument being offered by Trump himself. But, you know, you can certainly imagine conservative populists talking about the Trump era going forward and saying, look, you know, this was a great era for, you know, working class wages in America, and it was an era of immigration restriction, and that shows that lower rates of low-skilled immigration are good for, you know, working class Americans. Like, that's an argument that could be made. It wasn't really an argument Trump made at all during the campaign. Yeah. And it remains to be seen who will pick up on it. And it also, you know, it will depend on what happens with policy and under Biden. If Biden comes in, issues a bunch of executive orders that sort of take immigration enforcement off the table, and you immediately get another sort of migration wave on the border, then that will, create opportunities for conservatives to make arguments. If Biden comes in, changes the rules, and, you know, immigration only increases a little bit, and it's just sort of we're taking more refugees than we were before, then maybe you would say, well, we've come to a place where actually immigration is kind of a stable issue in American politics, that you had this, you know, backlash, and then immigration diminished, and then people stopped caring about it this much. So I think either of those are possibilities right now.
Sure. Yeah. And just as I completely agree with you, Ross, one of the important things when I was talking about there on immigration, the reason I'm bracketing it together in kind of the critical race theories, there's a huge difference between comprehensive immigration reform in exchange for border protection and, you know, and all the arguments around that and, you know, not deporting criminals or not deporting people who are convicted murderers. And that's something that is a progressive leftist position, and they need to own that. So that is something which very clearly the Biden administration or the Biden campaign adopted and said that they would enact. That's what I mean whenever I'm bracketing that together. But that also brings me to this question, Ross, on what we've learned around immigration and the future fights of the right, which is that you look at the Rio Grande Valley voting historically for Trump. You look at Miami-Dade County and many of the Hispanic community in Florida voting for Trump. You see larger margins across the entire country among this demographic group. Do you think that the right-wing meme of 2013, where it's like, we have to pass comprehensive immigration reform in order to win Latinos, is going to be dead from here on out? Or are they still going to secretly push it because it was always about, you know, giving big business a win on wages?
I think the meme is dead. It doesn't mean that there won't be people arguing for comprehensive immigration reform. I think I saw Lindsey Graham doing,
yeah, he's already out
doing
there,
just that, right? So there will still be people who make the argument, but the argument will become much more like, you know, this is good for American businesses. It's good for American growth. You know, we need a certain level of immigration for the sake of American competitiveness and so on, which was, I think, always, you know, the substantive argument.
Right.
I don't think anyone in Republican politics is going to give strong credence to the idea that you can't win Latino voters unless you support, you know, Barack Obama's immigration policy, because that clearly is wrong. That's just wrong. I think it's going to be the more interesting debate is, you know, it's the economic policy debate, right? Like, you know, the reason, the big reasons that those voters moved to Trump seemingly was the strong Trump economy, with things like the CARES Act and maybe debates about lockdowns and so on playing some role, and also social issues obviously playing some role. So what then you get into is what will be sort of the core economic argument on the right, which is, you know, was the Trump economy good because we just cut taxes and unleashed the free market, or was it good because of other policy steps, and, you know, that could be sort of pushed further by a more populist party? And so it's like, you know, assume now that you win more Latinos with economic arguments. What is that economic argument? That's the question.
This is one thing, Ross, just one sec, Marshall. I want Ross to articulate this, because this is a key thing from your column that a lot of people on the right are not capable of articulating, on why the Trump economy was good for workers and it didn't have necessarily anything to do with tax cuts. Your case is on looser monetary policy and immigration. Could you just lay that out here for our listeners?
Sure. I think that the thing that was distinctive about the Trump economy relative to prior economies and relative to what other Republican politicians supported was this combination of stringent controls on immigration. We really did have less immigration substantially than we'd had under previous presidents, joined to a Federal Reserve that basically let the economic expansion rip and didn't worry too much about inflation. You know, and when it did worry about inflation, Trump attacked Jerome Powell, right? So Trump was clearly an inflation dove throughout this presidency, which is the opposite of where the Republican Party had been under the Tea Party and in 2012. And I think that combination does explain a lot about why the Trump economy was better for the working class than the late Obama economy or the economy under George W. Bush. That, you know, when you combine less competition for low wage jobs with an economy that's sort of going full throttle, and you know, you aren't constantly sort of pulling it back to sort of try and keep inflation under control, that gets you good times for the American working class. And you know, that context, you know, there may come a moment when inflation becomes a problem and you have to adapt, but at the very least it's a case sort of against the kind of, you know, hard money views that dominated Republican approaches to inflation. And really it's a case against, you know, the Republican elite view circa 2012 was we need more immigration and we need tighter money. And the opposite approach on both counts seems to have worked pretty well for the American worker.
So as we're talking about Hispanic voters and whether or not that trend will continue, it seems to me that the issue you have is that America is depolarizing away from race, which is a good thing, and polarizing more around class and education. So what you're seeing of Hispanic voters countrywide is that Hispanic working class males are now more comfortable voting in similar ways to white working class males. Same thing with Black working class males. So is that a trend that will sort of continue regardless of who the Republicans pick in 2024 or the exact way that Republicans manifest themselves policy-wise? Because the part I'm not quite sure about is I don't see a world where Black men with high school educations are coming out to vote for Josh Hawley or to vote for Tom Cotton or for Ted Cruz. So how do you think about those trends when we focus more on the personalities that are going to sort of take the lead here?
Yeah, I don't think you can assume that they just accelerate dramatically. I think there's a kind of drift that makes sense that you would expect as the mm-hmm. parties, you know, polarize around education and also around sort of, you know, also around gender, right? Like, you know, you have increasingly a women's party and a men's party in the United States. You have an urban versus a rural party where a lot of the Hispanics and some African Americans who voted for Trump are in rural areas and are sort of voting more like their white neighbors. So all of that, all of those trends are sort of slow motion, and in very slow motion, they're likely to continue. But to become transformative, you need them to be accelerated somehow. And yeah, it's neither clear that the Republican Party has the policy agenda, nor that it has the natural post-Trump leader who's going to appeal to working class black men. And also you don't want the trend, you don't want this, the gender trend to just sort of continue. It's actually really, I think it's really bad for America, for our culture, to have a men's party and a women's party in an age right. when marriage rates are declining and family formation is collapsing and so on. And I mean, really, you know, if you're the Republicans right now, you look at these trends and you say, okay, we want to bring, right now we're getting working class voters who are doing pretty well financially to vote for us. So we're getting people without a college degree who are making, you know, $75,000-$100,000 a year. We want to push that a little bit further down the income ladder. We want to get the working class people making $50,000 a year, $40,000 a year. But then you also want to win more women, right? And you want to sort of set in motion some kind of policy and culture mix where you're actually encouraging the depolarization of the sexes by encouraging stable marriages and financially secure families and so on. So there's a lot going on there. But the bottom line is, I agree with the premise of your question. I don't look at the prospective 2024 field and say, okay, there's the guy or there's the woman who's going to sort of, you know, take you from 11% of the African American vote to 18% and take you to 42% of the Hispanic vote and so on. I think that's, there's a big there, and there are things that Trump, you know, Trump's style was effective with a lot of kind of disaffected voters, white and minority. And it's not clear that the Tom Cotton style or the Josh Hawley style, to say nothing of the Mike Pence style, gets you the same support. Like I'm totally there with Hawley, for instance, on a lot of the, you know, the Silicon Valley anti-monopoly stuff, right? But is that the issue that gets you extra votes in the Rio Grande Valley? Probably not.
I'm realizing there's one group, a very important group that we're ignoring here, especially in reference to the women idea, which is the sort of Lincoln Project, never Trump, Biden, Democrat category. Where do you think they're going to go? Because as I'm thinking about where did populists sort of get overconfident, I think people were way too dismissive about the need to minimize losses in the suburbs and minimize losses sort of college-educated voters, because they're clearly a demographic that can't just be wished away so that you could have this working class future where you don't have to worry about keeping, you know, moderately successful state school grads happy.
Yeah. I think the defeat in the suburbs for Republicans wasn't as bad as people thought it was going to be. And there does seem to be some evidence there, not elsewhere, but there, of kind of shy Trumpers, but more men than women, again, sort of, you know, college educated people in the suburbs whose neighbors just hate Trump and who didn't want to acknowledge that they were voting for Trump, but in the end did, or else voted for Republicans and not for Trump, which is why the Republicans in the House did pretty well. And I think there, to me, you know, it's a problem for Republicans that they can't compete in the sort of really elite spaces in American life, because those spaces have a lot of power. But I don't think there's an adaptation for the Republican Party right now that you know, wins back, you know, the wealthy suburbs of New York. But there, I think there is an adaptation that wins back, you know, some suburbanites in greater Atlanta or something. And that adaptation is not talking like a crazy person when you're president of the United States, right? Like that is one area where just not being Donald Trump, it seems like, gets you back a little bit of what you lost. Now,
I think you're completely right,
there are costs, right? Because part of Trump's appeal clearly helped the party with other voters, and you can't just say, oh, well, we'll get rid of his you know, his ranting and raving and still keep those voters, because there were things about Trump those voters liked. But if you're just talking about the, you know, the suburbanite who the Lincoln Project was targeting, some of those people will come back to the, some of those people are already came back to the Republican Party by voting for, you know, Republican Senate candidates and House candidates while not voting for Trump. So I don't think it's that hard to get, I don't think it's that hard to get certainly the people who are still voting for Republicans down ballot to stay with the party in the future.
One thing you mentioned, Ross, was about tech monopoly, but you also caveated it very well by being like, look, I don't know if that gets the Rio Grande Valley kind of exercise. One danger I see for the populist right, nascent right, whatever, is like an Elizabeth Warren syndrome, where you become obsessed with postal banking and with other things. Again, I'm not saying these things aren't important, while Bernie's just out there being like, we're doing Medicare for all. And it seems quite clear to me that a huge part of the Trump appeal was just a middle finger to the cultural elite, which again, I think is, I mean, I'm right there with you, but it needs to be filled in. How do we balance that in the coming years in terms of writing and talking about this? Because I saw a real phenomenon in 2016 where people tried to interpose their wants and desires and needs and others onto different candidates. When Trump ended up winning because he just connected on an extraordinarily visceral level with your average GOP primary voter and was able to excite people to come out and ultimately win in the three blue wall states. How are you thinking about that dynamic?
I mean, I think the Warren example is really good because, yeah, Warren is like the Ted Cruz of the left, right? You know, she's sort of the candidate of a particular slice of educated and ideological voters who just struggle to talk outside that group. And you can imagine a version of that on the Republican side where, you know, it's a candidate who just is too online and who really, really wants to talk about like shadow banning and, you know, what Twitter is doing wrong and how Twitter is mistreating conservatives and how, you know, what Facebook is doing wrong and all of these things that really matter to like people who talk about conservatism on the internet.
Yes.
And, you know, it don't matter at all to either normie Republican voters or the kind of normie swing voters that you need to reach. So I think the challenge is basically to sort of say, to make the like very online conservative critique of Silicon Valley a sub theme of a broader populist message where you're saying, here's the six things we're going to do to, you know, make the American economy work for everybody. And, you know, one of them is to reduce the power of Silicon Valley giants, which, by the way, will have good effects for, you know, if you're worried about censorship of right-wing voices online. But if the centerpiece of your argument is right-wing voices are being silenced online, that's not, you know, that's not the basis of a broad-based conservative pitch. I don't think. And I think I have a similar concerns about, you know, how long the sort of voter fraud theories of 2020 sort of get extended as, you know, as a narrative on the right. Mm-hmm. Like if your narrative in 2024 is the Democrats stole the election and we need to run on, you know, abolishing all mail-in balloting or something, I mean, that's going to be very popular with a segment of the Republican Party's base, but it's not a broad-based message. It's not the kind of message Trump succeeded with in 2016.
Yeah,
I like what you're saying about tech because it reminds me of the dynamic around the Section 230 debate, which is, from my perspective, the bigger impediment to the right taking on tech and corporate power isn't the exact nature of Section 230. It's the consumer welfare standard. It's sort of Borkian legal thought. And to me, the Section 230 debate and the debate about bias turns into this debate that's not really even about the issues you're talking about. So, for example, with the New York Post and Twitter, it had nothing to do with Section 230. If you're looking at sort of a lot of the broader questions that conservatives are actually exercised about, it's, to our sort of discussion's point, they're really ticked off about the power that massive companies hold for good or for ill. And in many ways, these online debates, Trump's executive orders, I mean, there was even good videos of Trump bringing up Section 230 at some of his rallies in the last closing weeks of the election. And you just have to realize it's a total impediment to any sort of actual understanding of the problem. You can repeal Section 230 and you would still have a lot of the concerns that the right even has. And in many ways, there's this frustrating dynamic where the right looks at the fact that the left also wants to repeal Section 230, but because they're not thinking critically about it, they don't understand that Joe Biden's critique of Section 230 is that it's far too generous to QAnon, that it's far too generous right. to Alex Jones. You just get this really uncritical, oh, America's rising up against the tech oligarchs. It's like, no, dude, that's actually not what's happening here. And you really need to think more critically about this issue. But how do you just think about the sort of gap between the meta culture things and that?
Well, so the Section 230 thing is, it's the reason that right populists and Joe Biden can converge on it is that it is a mechanism for threatening tech companies, right? If you want to threaten tech companies, which both the right and left have reasons to want to do, threatening their Section 230 status is a good way to do it. But the end game, yeah, the end games of what you're trying to do are going to look very different. But I think it's a question of like Section 230 stuff. It's something that belongs in the elite conversation about how do you reform Silicon Valley giants. It doesn't belong in the, you know, Trump rallies popular conversation. And and this was, you know, one of the, I think, reasonable critiques of like the last month of the Trump campaign was that it was basically doing what the progressive left did in the Democratic primary, which was sort of becoming very online and dominated by Twitter disputes. And Biden beat the very online Democrats in the spring, and then he beat a very online Republican in the fall. So you should never, yeah, if you're a national Republican candidate for office, you should never be talking about Section 230. You should be talking in very general terms about how these big companies have too much power and, you know, their control of online speech is part of that. And we need to think about ways to have a more democratic internet and a more democratic economy. Small
right.
D.
You know, it's funny, Russ. We had Jane Kosin on right before the elections.
Oh, right. This was her. Yeah. She had the very shout out Jane theme.
Right. Shout out to Jane, who will soon be your colleague on the argument.
Yes.
She'll soon be your colleague. So everybody listen to that. And it was funny. We were talking about the 1619 order. And I was like, look, like I'm down for this, but your time is way better spent just getting another stimulus check out the door. Like I'm very certain you would have won re-election if you just sent another goddamn check. And yet, look, I mean, this is what the right in many ways wants to talk about. So let's wrap this up in these terms, which is that we've diagnosed what we lost. We've diagnosed like kind of what Trump changed. What are the various trajectories that you see for the Democratic and Republican parties under a Joe Biden administration?
I mean, for the Democrats, you know, there's a very live possibility of ongoing miserable civil war, right? Where, you know, you have a situation where the centrist candidate won the election, but narrowly enough that his power is going to be limited and he's going to be forced to either make deals with Mitch McConnell or not govern at all. And this, on the one hand, you know, the left lost a lot of battles over the last year. On the other hand, they're going to find lots of things to be very angry about under Biden if he's at all successful. And that's, yeah, that's a setup for a lot of infighting. And especially with, you know, if a lot depends on Trump's role and sort of how much the liberal coalition is still defined against ex-President Trump. But certainly the left versus center conflict in the Democratic Party will be significant. I think on the right, the question is, you know, again, it hinges in part on what Biden does, but, you know, can you find an affirmative agenda while acting in opposition? And this was something I think Republicans failed to do under Obama, which was part of why Trump was able to come along and just sort of sweep the board clear of all the Republican politicians, because, you know, say what you will about his 2016 agenda, he had a big, bold agenda, right? In a way that the other Republicans didn't. So that's the question. If you get like some sort of Tea Party 2.0 where Republicans are freaking out about the Biden deficits or something, that does not set the party up well for 2024 and 2028. Maybe it sets you up to win a few extra House seats in the midterms, but it doesn't set you up. You have to figure out a way to say, here are the four things the Biden administration is doing that are terrible, and I oppose them to the hilt. But, you know, here are the two things that, you know, we can either work with Biden on, or, you know, that sort of represent our own economic agenda that's an alternative to him. I mean, I think the last thing I'd say, though, is, you know, you are also, the culture war does not go away. It never goes away. And I think the advantage that the right has in terms of mobilization is that, you know, things like, you know, things like these debates, like the one you referenced over my own newspaper, 1619 Project, and the teaching of American history and so on, these provide reasons clearly for a lot of people to be leery of giving the Democratic Party full power. And that leeriness seems to me to be the Republican Party's biggest advantage in many ways. That Republican Party is a coalition that's a mess of competing groups that can't agree on anything. It doesn't have much of an agenda often. You know, it didn't do much policy work under Trump. But even so, people don't want to hand all the power in America to liberalism. And that, I think, is it's a insufficient but still useful starting place for a Republican Party that, you know, hopes to actually govern the country someday.
So my last quick question here. Something that really fascinated me and Sagar is that it seems that the socialism attacks really worked. And that's something that depresses me, because Joe Biden isn't a socialist. He's obviously not a socialist. But the sort of effectiveness of that attack really did mean something. So how do you just think about that dynamic from a policy and a political perspective?
I don't think it's a bad thing for conservative populists that attacks on socialism resonated. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, first of all, conservative populists are not, you know, they're not going to be the right wingers for Medicare for all, right? Like, you know, whatever affirmative government policies conservative populists end up supporting, they're not going to be as sweeping as what Bernie Sanders wants, right? Yes. Like, you know, right wingers for industrial policy and family friendly tax reform seems totally compatible with also saying, you know, we don't want the federal government completely taking over the healthcare system, or, you know, doing the 16 things that Elizabeth Warren wants to do, and so on. And also, it's, you know, I mean, the socialism attacks are also connected. They're connected to cultural stuff, right? Like, a lot of the people, at least anecdotally, for whom those attacks resonated in Hispanic and Latino communities, right, were, you know, Cuban and Venezuelan immigrants who obviously have strongly negative associations with socialism. But what they were seeing that reminded them of the revolutions in their own countries was the sort of some of the social justice and woke activist stuff, right? So, it was this, the statues being pulled down, right? So it wasn't, oh, you know, the Democrats want to spend too much money and therefore they're socialists. It's, you know, the Democrats seem to have this revolutionary vanguard in their party, and that reminds us of revolutionary vanguards in our ancestral countries, and we don't like it. And that's not a critique of healthcare policy. That's a critique of sort of the mood and ambitions of the left. So to that extent, I think, you know, if you're saying socialism means far left moods and ambitions gaining power in the Democratic Party, I think it's okay for conservative populists to, you know, have that language floating around.
Yeah. And quick thing, because I do need to clarify my position. I agree with you if it's the latter, right? Revolution, those sort of things. The part that I was just concerned about was sort of the meme of socialism sucks, which I just saw leading into that debt and deficit sort of. There's a toxic version of socialism sucks, and that's the one I don't want in 2022.
Absolutely. And if it just comes back to socialism sucks, therefore we should have no healthcare plans, and we should be hard money fanatics and only care about the deficit, then that will have just cycled us back to some of the dead ends of the Obama era, which, you know, under my thesis that, you know, the Western world is decadent would not be surprising, but I'd rather not go in that particular circle.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Ross. It's so important to understand for a lot of people out there that the socialism attack really encompassed, I think, that latter cultural Marxism much more so than the economic policy. I would just point to the fact that, look, a $15 minimum wage passed in Florida by like 60%.
Right. Yep.
At the same time that Trump won the state by a historic margin.
Lots of voters in Florida are against socialism and in favor of a higher minimum wage. And
right.
Somewhere in that combination is the challenge for conservative populism.
That's exactly it. Ross, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Oh, everybody checks out Ross's book, The Decadent Society, and his podcast, The Argument, where Jane will soon be joining him. It's absolutely excellent and will continue to be so. So thank you, Ross.
Thank you, guys. Have a good one.
Thanks, Ross.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. As we mentioned, please drop us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or leave us a review, sending a screenshot to realignmentpod@gmail.com.
As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast, and we will see you all on Thursday.